Before I let him get started, I just want to indicate that I am not going to use the senatorial titles that these gentlemen have all earned. I'm going to use their full names, not to be disrespectful, but to continue to emphasize what their names are so that they can gain that name recognition that we all want to see. So I'm going to start with Scott Brown. 1 minute, please.
Thank you, George. I want to thank the Mount Washington Valley Economic Council, all of you for coming, our sponsors, our Republican friends, our independents, and the good Democrats that are here as well. It's good to see everybody so bright and early. I want to introduce my wife, Gail. It's good to have her here. I'm running for the United States Senate because I care about New Hampshire. I care about the fact that we seem to be losing our New Hampshire advantage. Right now, we're focusing, and we need to focus on the devastating effects of Obamacare, focusing on our lack of a good energy policy. Our economic policy is flat. Foreign policy, our foes don't fear or respect us. Our allies don't trust us. And I believe it's a failure of the president in that regard. Immigration is at the forefront. People are deeply concerned about where we're heading on immigration, our debt and our deficit, a whole host of things to talk about. I'm honored to be here with Jim and Bob. I have a lot of respect for them and their supporters. And I look forward to, after this primary is over, whoever prevails, uniting our party, because a united Republican Party is Senator Shaheen's worst nightmare. Thank you.
Thank you. And before I...
Thank you.
Please. Yes. Jim Rubens, before I let you go, just a reminder, our timekeeper is sitting right in front of you, gentlemen, and he is holding up the number of remaining seconds, and we're pretty merciless about that. So thank you. Jim Rubens.
And indeed, good morning, folks, from the North Country. Our nation faces a compendium of grave challenges, graver than I've seen during my entire lifetime. And I've lived here in the state 40 years. I've started 10 small businesses here. I've worked with my hands. I've been a tree surgeon and a steel cutter. I've invested in high-tech companies to make my living. And among these challenges, debt, deficits, our stagnant economy, foreign policy, and extreme levels of mistrust in government. And I'd like to do what I did in the state Senate when I served you folks over a 20-year period in public life and during my time in the state Senate. I'd like to bring bold ideas that break through the gridlock in Washington, that solve real problems and improve people's lives. I can give you some examples in this last 20 seconds. We have the Robert Frost Charter School up here in North Conway. I wrote and passed the charter school law. That was really controversial. I had to explain it to a lot of folks. I got electricity competition going in the state that has saved people millions of dollars. I wrote the state's victim restitution law. I got SB2 voting passed into law, which has increased voter turnout 5 times in the 2/3 of districts that have adopted it. So I'd like to bring that approach to Washington, problem solving, improve lives, turn this country around. Thank you, folks.
Thank you. Bob Smith.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for turning out. It's a lot of, it's like a sentimental journey being here today. I've seen a lot of faces. I won't embarrass anybody by mentioning them, but it's great to see some of you again. You got a little bit older. Dick Badger, he didn't get any older. He's just the same old guy, good realtor. My wife and I, of course, lived in Carroll County for a number of years, since 1970. Mary Jo, I just want to introduce Mary Jo, she's in the back there. And, you know, it's our country's in trouble. That's the bottom line. And when your country's in trouble, you should step up and do what you think you can do to help solve the problems. You're not going to do it as one person, that's for sure. But it's going to take leadership, and it's going to take strong leadership to get it done. We have a lot of problems. I'm sure you'll be asking about them here. But I would just close on this point in a few seconds. 10 seconds. Bold is the key word here. You have to show the difference between who they are and who we are as conservative Republicans. If we do that, we'll win. If we don't, we walk away from principle, we lose.
Bob Smith. Bob Smith's going to get the first of my, and perhaps my only really aggressive question here. So all three of you have to get ready for this one.
We got 1 minute to answer, right?
You have 1 minute, but we can give you a follow-up if we really feel you need more time. Scott Brown moved to New Hampshire late last year after many years in Massachusetts. Bob Smith ran for president briefly as an independent, moved to Florida and looked at running for Senate there before coming back to New Hampshire. And Jim Rubens has for years focused solely on opposition to casino gambling, a state issue. Why should New Hampshire Republicans want you as their nominee, Bob Smith?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that at 18 years of representing the state, I think if you look at those 5,000 votes in terms of our values as a party, what we stand for in terms of anti-regulation, cutting spending, balancing the budget, doing all the things that we believe in as parties, pro-gun, pro-life, all of those parts of our party platform, I think you'll find that I'm the only candidate here who totally supports that platform. And I am consistent with those votes, and I ask you to review that because there's a good, when you look at what somebody did in the past, it's a pretty good indicator of what they're going to do in the future. And for those who have indicated, why are you coming back at this stage? And I said, there's no age limit on patriotism. I believe I can help. And frankly, wherever Scott Brown came from, he's a resident of New Hampshire. I could care less where he came from, our main, where he moved from, or where he lives. The main issue is what are the views that he represents? Are they the views we need as a party to take it to Gene Shaheen? Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd hold your applause here, and Jim Rubens, if you would follow up next. You might all want to hold this microphone just a hair further away from your mouth.
Okay. It helps me to have lived in the state 20 years and to have served in public life for 20 years and started, run, and worked here in the state for those 40 years of time. I know the state. I know the different parts of the state. What I bring to the table is what I have done during that period of time. I'm a thoughtful, principled person, and I'm a statesman, and I've shown my ability to solve really serious problems at the state level. It was hard to deal with electricity competition and the aftermath of that, the litigation that went on for several years. Getting the charter school law written and passed required me to bring people together. My chairmanship of the Granite State Coalition Against Expanded Gambling, I was up against a foe, a Las Vegas company that wanted to install a casino here that outspent me 100 and 1,000 to 1. I had to bring people together, people who had never worked together before. I had to explain issues. I had to explain issues in a way that caused new people to join into that process. I'd like to take that same approach. We have serious problems in the country. It's going to take imagination. It's going to take boldness. It's going to take explaining things. It's going to take bringing people together to solve these problems. And as the debate goes forward, I'll get a chance to talk about some of the suggestions I'm making to solve our country's problems. You'll see they're imaginative, and it's going to take work to get them down and done, and that's how we're going to turn this country around. Thank you, folks.
Thank you. Scott Brown.
Thanks, Jim. My mom was a waitress. My dad was an airman at Pease. I was born at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. The first 2.5 years of my life, I lived on Islington Street in Portsmouth. Long and strong ties, just like everybody up here, including Senator Shaheen. And the one thing we all have in common is that we care very much about New Hampshire and its direction. We're losing our New Hampshire advantage. People can argue about our birthright and where we're from. I'm going to argue and talk about where we're going, and where we're going is not a good direction right now. We have a debt of $17+ trillion. We have Obamacare affecting businesses and individuals on a daily basis. We have so many troubles right now, and we have a senator in place right now. While she cares about New Hampshire, she's not voting like she cares about New Hampshire because she's voting 99% of the time with the failed policies of President Obama. And what does that mean to you? It means you're paying more at the checkout counter. You're paying higher gas prices. You're paying more for your health insurance. We are in trouble right now, and we need good leaders. And any one of us up here, good men, all of us, would make a better senator than Senator Shaheen.
Thank you. I'm going to start with Scott Brown, and I'm going to move into an area where you have some agreement, which is opposition to Obamacare. And I'm going to violate my rules right off the bat and give you 2 full minutes to give us some of your thoughts with regard to it. In particular, I want to ask you, to the degree that you wish to repeal Obamacare or end it completely, how are you going to, and if you wish to, retain some of the provisions of Obamacare, such as no pre-existing condition, coverage of children up to age 26, the creation of accountable care organizations that are reimbursed not on the basis of the volume of services they provide, but rather on the basis of their outcomes. And the fact that 40,000 New Hampshire residents have signed up for Obamacare at an average of, a subsidized average of about $87 per month. Which of those things would you try to retain? Which of those things are not of particular interest to you? Scott Brown.
Well, first of all, I voted to repeal Obamacare 4 times. It's a terrible law. Nancy Pelosi, she pushed it through without reading it, as you know. You have to pass it before you know what's in it. Well, I read everything. I try to figure out what's involved in a bill, and it's not a good bill. And had Senator Shaheen read it, she would have understood that 18 new taxes were going to be implemented, that we would have had $750 billion cut from our seniors' Medicare, and that our businesses are going to be dramatically affected through a medical device tax and a whole host of other things. Most recently, our nursing home and rehabilitation facilities that our moms and grandparents are in got slashed a 10% cut right off the top. That's going to affect their care and coverages. It's a terrible bill. It's affecting businesses after the election, of course, and they are devastated because they're very unsure about whether they're going to hire, grow, and expand. And people in Washington, including our own senator, want you to think, oh, it's the only option. Obamacare is the only option. Well, with all due respect, it's not. We have very intelligent, hardworking people in our state that can do it better than the federal government. We can address every single one of those concerns and incorporate them into a bill that works for New Hampshire. To think that the federal government is the only answer is a false answer. If you look at the VA right now, that's Obamacare in a couple of years. The lack of control, the bureaucracy, the delays, you see it happening now. We have 10 out of our 26 hospitals not in the network. People are paying higher deductibles. They're getting lesser coverages. They have longer drives to get to their care facilities. Remember, Senator Shaheen was in Portsmouth in 2009 with the president and said, by the way, you can keep your doctor, you can keep your hospital, you can keep your health care facilities, and you're going to probably get a check for $2,500. Well, guess what? None of that has happened. False promises. And in fact, a lot of the businesses are not hiring and growing and expanding because they're deeply concerned about what's happening. We could have a whole program just on this. Feel very passionately about it. We can repeal it, and we can put in place one that respects our rights and freedoms, and we can do it better than the federal government.
Scott Brown, would you hang on for just a second? Well, no, 30-second follow-up. In terms of specifically those issues, though, with regard to coverage with no pre-existing condition, children up to 26, accountable care organizations, would you be comfortable repealing Obamacare without having those replaced immediately or immediately available?
Listen, other states have incorporated all the things that we care about. I reference and care about those things as well. We've already done it. They've already done it in other states. Our state should have that very same opportunity. If in fact, first of all, you have to repeal it to start and do anything. The option would be to freeze everybody in place with what they have and actually allow competition and allow people to go out and get better plans if they so choose, respecting our rights and freedoms and allow us to go get better plans, meanwhile freezing all the things that people are like, and then get to work and go fix it.
Thank you. Jim Rubens, 2 minutes on the original question.
Yes. I think all of us here at the table agree that we need to repeal Obamacare, so that's not a question among the three of us. The question is how to do that and how to solve the actual problems in healthcare. There are three huge problems in U.S. healthcare that are not resolved by Obamacare. Obamacare, we have the highest healthcare costs in the world, twice per capita what our industrial nation competitors spend, and it's forcing jobs offshore. We have access. Even Obamacare will leave 20 to 30 million people uninsured, and the quality of healthcare in the U.S. is not where it needs to be. By the year 2020, it's projected that we'll be spending $1 trillion on obesity and diabetes management and related disease. So we've got to deal with these problems. So to repeal Obamacare, Republicans and like myself, I'm going to the table with a package of reforms that actually address these core problems. And they don't require people being forced to buy insurance. And they don't require massive Obamacare will be costing another $1.4 trillion of printed money over the next 10 years, according to the latest CBO analysis. So some of the things that I'm proposing to replace it, we need beefed up catastrophic care pools at the state, possibly at the federal level, so that people with pre-existing conditions can get the care they need. We need to beef up the community clinics that we have, the Amanusic Clinic in Littleton and surrounding in the North Country, an example of these community health clinics, because they're able to produce primary care at about half the cost of the hospital and insurance-based system. And these models have shown this to be the case. They're controlled by the communities. They're bottom-up. They're 51% 100% controlled by patients. There are nonprofit insurance that are affiliated with them, insurers to make sure those savings accrue to the operations. We need tort reform. We need Congress to stop blocking things like negotiating for the cost of pharmaceuticals. We pay the highest costs in the world. We spend between $60 and $200 billion a year in Medicare and Medicaid fraud. Congress needs to finally deal with this stuff. So there's a long list of things that I'm proposing that do not require people, do not force people to buy insurance, do not restrict the kinds of insurance products that people would purchase. They're on my website, jimrubens.com, and it would take another 10 or 20 minutes to go through it all, and thank you very much.
How about another 30 seconds, if I could? You talk about your opposition to forcing people to buy insurance.
Yeah.
How do you permit folks to purchase insurance with pre-existing conditions without having an individual mandate?
Right.
Why wouldn't I simply wait till I got sick, buy some insurance, use it up, and then cancel the insurance when I was done? No insurance company can survive that
right.
kind of experience.
Exactly true, which is why we need to restructure insurance so that the marketplace is producing insurance products that is attractive to people. We don't compel people to buy food, and we're not in America going to compel people to buy insurance. Young people are going to resist it. They're going to pay the fines. The whole methodology in Obamacare is going to collapse and drive up costs. We've got to bring costs down. So what I'm proposing, just an example, among the many bullet points on my website on insurance reform, we need to provide a legal structure for what I call long-term health insurance, like long-term life insurance or term life insurance, so that young people are incentivized when they're young and healthy and invincible to buy insurance at a low cost, and the actuarial numbers will work out such that they will be, again, incentivized to purchase this. I mentioned the catastrophic care pools as a portion of the methodology by which we will get people able to get insurance. I'll stop there.
Yes. Thank you. Bob Smith.
Hard to do this.
It is. Well, but that's 2.5 minutes. Yeah. We're going to keep adding time as needed. Bob Smith, could you comment again on the original question, which was, with the repeal of Obamacare, how do you address the desire that many people have for the non-pre-existing condition, children up to 26, creation of accountable care organizations, et cetera?
Well, first of all, Obamacare should be repealed. The way it was passed, as Scott said, was basically a disgrace. It was forced down our throats without any debate. Nobody read the law. It was an outrageous result. And here's an interesting perspective that hasn't been brought up here. If it's so good, why does it have to be mandated? How about letting us opt out if we want to? Wouldn't that be nice? If we could say, you know what, if you like Obamacare, knock yourself out. Go ahead and have it. But how about if we don't want it? How about if we'd like to make our own choices in life for a change? How about if under the American Constitution, we exercise our freedoms, which are to choose the doctor we want, to choose the hospital we want? There were several hospitals that, as you know, that now patients aren't being treated under Obamacare. And of course, insurance companies there were two or three dozen of them when Gene Shaheen became governor. Now we're down to one or two. So this is a mandate that is wrong. It's not who we are. Yes, we can protect, as the question implies, pre-existing conditions. We can have competition in the marketplace. You want to take care of these issues? Put competition in the marketplace. Who's going to buy an insurance policy that's not going to protect pre-existing conditions? Nobody. So they're not going to be able to sell it. So they're going to have to put it in there. And then I support that. And I support tort reform, as has been said, and selling insurance across state lines. If I can buy a policy in Memphis, Tennessee, that's cheaper than the one offered in Conway, so what? Let's go get it. It may work the other way on another issue. And another issue which is very important here, which has also not been discussed, and that is, you know, all of these nations throughout the world that have tried this, it's not working. Ask anybody from Canada. You have a 2 or 3 tiered system. It's not working. So it's not what America is. It's not who we are as a people. I'm sorry, Gene, but when you tell me I can have permission to have my doctor, that's not your right. That's not who you are. I have the right to pick my own doctor. I don't need your permission.
Thank you. And a follow-up also for you. Go ahead. For all three of them, if you would. Right now, we have all the rest of us subsidizing those folks who have the legal right to walk into any emergency room and demand treatment. Hospitals can't turn those folks away. We're paying for those folks to get their treatment anyway. by repealing Obamacare and putting more people off of medical insurance without necessarily having a replacement in place, aren't we just continuing to subsidize those individuals who refuse to get their insurance coverage but still demand that care when they walk into the emergency room?
Well, I didn't hear a lot of complaints about that. I think all of us where do you go for health insurance, where do you go for medical treatment if you live somewhere else in the world? They all come here, even the dictators from the Middle East, wherever. They come here for treatment. We have the best health care system in the world, for heaven's sakes. And we have issues, and that's one of them. The fact that when we go to the hospital or when we go to the doctor, we being those who have insurance and have taken the opportunity to take care of ourselves, yes, we pay for it. But that could be improved, no doubt about it. But it doesn't mean you throw out the best health care system in the world and create a government mandate. And let me add one more point. I don't support a state mandate either, as Scott Brown did in Massachusetts. I think the individual has the right under our Constitution to pick and choose their insurance company. I don't want the state dictating it either. And I certainly don't want the feds to do it.
Bob Smith, a one-minute question for all three of you. The cost of prescription medications remains an issue for us. We pay more pretty much than anyone in the rest of the world, sometimes 50% more for particular drugs, sometimes 500% more. How would you address that, or do you think it's not a problem or an issue? It's simply a matter of the free market working as it does?
Well, unfortunately, under Obamacare, the free market is not going to work. You know, think about it. Why do we have the best medical technology in the world? Why do we have the best pharmaceuticals? Who's producing the pharmaceuticals? Who's producing the new miracle drugs? Who's producing the robotic technology in medicine today? Why is that happening? Because of competition in the marketplace. So now who's going to do that? The United States is the only country in the world, for the most part, that has that capacity now through the competitive structure of our system. Now, that's taken away. So now we're going to be a provider, a service provider for everybody, many who don't want to bother getting insurance because they don't think they're ever going to get sick and don't care, and some who need it. And those who need it and can't afford it, we are a benevolent society, we take care of them. That's the bottom line. But now, and you ask anybody in these other countries, Germany or any place else that has a socialized medical system, they're gonna tell you they don't do the research. We do it, and they ride on our horse. And we're making a terrible mistake. We've now dropped ourselves from the leaders in the world to another one of the pack as a socialized medicine. It's wrong, and it's not who we are.
Thank you, Bob Smith. Jim Rubens.
Yes. I invest in pharmaceutical products and services as part of the way I make a living, so I genuinely believe with Senator Smith with respect to the ingenuity in our country. However, we've got a bought and paid for Congress. If we want lower pharmaceutical prices in the United States of America, and this is my party that does this, we filibuster every time the question comes up of allowing the federal government to negotiate for the cost of pharmaceuticals. Our government on Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, et cetera, spends $80 billion a year on pharmaceuticals. We pay the highest prices in the world because our Congress can't negotiate for medical pharmaceuticals like we do for paper clips or road paving. That's got to stop. Why is that the case? In 2012, there were 1,200 lobbyists, pharmaceutical industry lobbyists in Washington. They spent $200 million lobbying Congress, and they prevented Congress from doing the job it ought to be doing for the public. This is why I support a system of voluntary public financing for elections so that individuals going to Washington, like myself, are not held captive by special interests and can do the job that needs to be done for the public of the United States of America.
Thank you. Scott Brown.
Thank you, George. You actually asked two questions, one to Bob and then a follow-up. I'd like to kind of address both of them if I could. The uncompensated health care pool is a problem for many hospitals and for states. It affects their state budgets. That's a reason why Massachusetts in particular addressed this very important concern. They developed a plan that worked for them, passed 198-2. Everyone was at the table. What works for them may not work for New Hampshire. We can develop our own plan like other states have attempted to do so they don't have to deal with the bureaucracy of the federal government. And when you're talking about drugs and drug development, the FDA and a lot of the bureaucracies are making it incredibly difficult for new drugs to be developed and actually brought to market here. A lot of them are going out of the country, obviously. So we need to work to streamline that process to allow people to want to stay and invest here and actually create new products. Obamacare is a real damper, a real wet blanket on that through the medical device tax and a whole host of other anti-business initiatives. I think we can do better. We can develop a plan that works for our state, and we can repeal in Obamacare and put something in place that works.
Thank you. Thank you. Staying generally in the realm of healthcare, but moving over to the VA, Veterans Administration hospitals, I think horrified all of us with the inaction and the inappropriate actions that they've taken with regard to scheduling and providing access to our veterans for health care. What would you do specifically as a U.S. Senator to address that? And in particular, why do we have a separate health care system for veterans? Why and will that ever be the kind of health care system that they should get? Should they not simply be part of and have access to the general health care system, be able to utilize it, funded by the United States government and our commitment to them? Scott Brown?
Well, first of all, two really good points within that. I was on the Veterans Committee, just retired after 35 years in the military as a colonel, worked at the Pentagon, understand these issues. When I was on the Veterans Committee, we held hearings. We put Shinseki on notice about 2.5 years ago, and they did nothing. We held hearings, I held hearings in Massachusetts at that point. We hired people to actually address and put the VA in touch with the soldier one-on-one so they could solve those very real problems. When there was the problem with the VA, I was the first one to call for Shinseki's removal. Senator Shaheen did it hours before. I think we all agree that our heroes deserve the best medical care. And as I said, if you look at the VA and you look at Obamacare, they have a lot of similarities and they will be very similar in years to come. The fact that they passed a bill recently, they shouldn't be taking a bow, because it took deaths of soldiers to get to this point. And it's a good first step, but it still has not been implemented. And we still have all these very real problems. And people should be allowed to get that card and go to any healthcare facility that they want. I'm out of time, but it's something I would hope that you would continue to allow us to talk about, because it's a very important issue.
Please take another 30 seconds. In particular, should we be phasing out the Veterans Administration medical system and simply allowing veterans to have better access and no-cost access to the general health care system?
It's a conversation I think we need to have, because we have to look at efficiencies. There are certain geographic areas that may support a specific VA complex in their region. Remember, Senator Shaheen promised us a full-service hospital when she criticized then Senator Sununu. She has not delivered on that promise. As a result, a lot of our veterans are having to travel hours to get care and coverages. Yes, I believe we should reevaluate that system. I believe that we have the best hospitals, doctors, nurses, healthcare facilities in the world in our region, and those heroes should have the opportunity to get that care and coverage wherever they need it.
Thank you. Jim Rubens.
This problem was not fixed. When this story broke about VA hospital administrators falsifying wait lists and literally killing veterans who were on these wait lists, when this story broke early this spring, that outraged me. And so I immediately called for veterans being able to obtain vouchers and get care where they need and when they need it. We honor our veterans by giving them the care that we promised them. These are folks who've served our country, and this is a promise we made, and it must be kept, and it's inviolable under any circumstance. Now, there's a problem. Senators Brown and Shaheen were in the United States Senate and heard testimony as to the falsification of these wait lists in April 2012, and nothing was done about this. The problem persisted. It grew larger. Every single VA hospital administrator this past year self-monitored and awarded themselves bonuses ranging from $8,000 to $10,000 a copy.
Jim,
so
I'm going to give you another 30 seconds, but I'd also like you to address that issue of whether there should be a continuing existence of the VA for another 30 seconds.
There are services provided in the VA system that are not being provided effectively and can't. For example, veterans have unique needs. For example, veterans with PTSD, et cetera, and long-term health conditions. But it would be much better if we had veterans able to access, just like I am, any hospital, any doctor of my choice, and hopefully we can get rid of Obamacare and put that back in place. Veterans deserve no less than what I get, choosing the doctor and hospital that best meets their need. It's a promise we made to veterans. It's inviolable, and we must retain it, and veterans should not be getting second-class care under any circumstance. This matter of acting on this it's an instrumentality, it's an example of leadership. The fact that Senator Shaheen and Senator Brown learned about this 2.5 years ago and did nothing about it is unconscionable to me. Unconscionable to me.
I'm sorry. I'm wrestling with Jim Rubens, who's my most aggressive time user. But it's constructive. It's positive. But we're going to try and make him be better behaved. You're going to speak again to the issue of the VA, what we should do about it, and the issue of whether we should continue to have a separate VA healthcare system.
Well, first of all, every veteran should have a gold card or work at something similar, whatever. Call it a gold card to go any facility, anywhere in the world, wherever you are, and be taken care of. We owe it to them. They earned it, period. It's not a question of giving them anything. They earned it. So what this issue is, this scandal, is very interesting because it's about priorities. Isn't it interesting? We have plenty of money to take care of illegal immigrants in this country, but we don't have enough to take care of people, illegal immigrants. We don't have enough money to take care of our veterans. That's the excuse that was given. It's a moral issue. It's a moral issue. It's much deeper. And I know how that process works. I don't blame Senator Brown for this. I honestly don't. They hide this stuff. It's your priorities in the government. Our veterans are not a high priority in the Obama administration, period. They're not a high priority when they're in office, when they're in the service and performing, when they're told to go to Iraq or Afghanistan, 5 or 6 tours. Talk to some of them, they'll tell you that. And they're not a high priority when they get home, period. So as far as the VA, give me the other 30 seconds, I hope.
The other 30 seconds, but remember to talk about the VA.
All right, as far as the VA is concerned, what I have found after 18 years of working with veterans, from everything from soup to nuts in terms of getting the medals they earned that they didn't get and their medical facilities, veterans like the concept of a veterans administration. They like that. And they can still work. We can still work within that system, but when there are specialists needed or hospitals they need to go to or some specific illness that they need special attention for, let them have the card. They can go to the VA hospital for outpatient services, or they can go somewhere else, Boston, Mayo Clinic, wherever. Take the card, go in, and get your service. That's where I would do.
Excuse me,
thank you. Well, let's see how much record correcting is necessary. Why don't we pass that back to Scott Brown, and we'll go right back across with 30 seconds with each of
you. Thank you very much. It's interesting to listen to Jim talk about what I've done and to misrepresent my record after 35 years of service, being on the Veterans Committee, holding that hearing, putting Shinseki on notice. He said it was in the end of 12 that we held that hearing, give or take. I was gone 7 months later, and during that 7 month period, we held a hearing on this very issue. We hired additional staff. We actually put soldiers in touch with the VA one-on-one to solve those individual problems. For the last year and a half, I have been unable to obviously work on that very important issue. Called for Shinseki to be removed, one of the first ones in our country. So with all due respect, to question my service and patriotism and my dedication to veterans is, I believe, unconscionable as well, Jim. Thank you.
30 seconds, Jim, and then 30 seconds, Bob.
I'm questioning your failure to stand up and demand the problem be fixed. You called it mind-boggling when you heard about this.
I only know what happened,
and the problem did not get solved. Had I had the power of being a United States Senator, like Gene Shane and Scott Brown, I would have raised the rafters. It's unconscionable that vets were treated this way. The problem persisted and grew worse for the subsequent 2 years. Unconscionable.
Thank you. Bob Smith, any final comments?
Well, I think I'm the only person here who was a veteran who served in the war zone during Vietnam. And I understand what it's like. I understand what veterans go through. And they need the opportunity to be able to get the services they need when they need them. No questions asked. I felt the same way about Agent Orange. They shouldn't have to get on their knees and beg and prove that they were in some particular area. They served in Vietnam. They deserve the help. My God, think about what has happened with our veterans down through the years, the things they've done for our country. Whether it's Normandy or wherever, go to some of these places. Colin Powell said it best. He said, all we ask for is a place to bury our dead. We go places all over the world. These are our people who save our country. They deserve the best. There shouldn't be any question. We shouldn't have to have hearings. The point is that these people were mistreated by an administration that could care less about veterans. That's not their priority. It's illegal immigrants. It's everything else. It's Obamacare, whatever.
Thank you. Thank you. One of the things we do here is try to get to know the candidates personally a little bit better, and I turned to my six-year-old grandson for a couple of questions, that just short answer questions, sort of eases things up a little bit here as well. His first question to you was, do you enjoy thunderstorms?
No, I don't. I actually was hit by lightning. So you can tell I don't enjoy it. No yes or no here. I'll use up my... Give me my 30 seconds. Give me my 30. This is one. Even Jason the tracker over there, he's got some good stuff now for the Democrats. Look, I was 90 cents an hour carrying irrigation pipes when I was a kid. We had a thunderstorm. And of course, my uncle, who I was working for, he said, "Hey, we got to get these irrigation pipes. It's going to rain. What do we need irrigation pipes for?" So anyway, the lightning hit the end of the irrigation pipe, came down the pipe, but when you carry those, they're 4-inch pipes. So you carry them like this. You don't squeeze them, but you hold them in hand. So when it came down the pipe, it hit my hand, went up my arms, and knocked me down and dropped the pipe. So. You know what? If it had been just a little bit stronger, these guys would be debating by themselves today. But.
Yes, no answer. Jim Rubens, do you like thunderstorms?
I am afraid of thunderstorms. I was hiking. I'm glad I didn't get it, but I was hiking on Mount Hube about 30 years ago, and I got caught. I was solo up there, and I got caught at the very top of the mountain. With a thunderstorm, and the lightning began striking, and the thunder, and so I crouched down, as one is advised to do, on the balls of my toes, in a little hummock, and waited for it to pass over, and I can tell your son, one thing that was amazing to me, because the thunder was actually passing over my head, the progress of the butting together of the two air masses, about 20 to 30 yards over my head, and I could actually hear the thunder like going across the sky like a zipper. So it was an amazing experience. I don't recommend it.
I'm absolutely mystified. Okay. So this is definitely the most interesting part of the debate.
Bob, I like you even more now. That was a great story. No, I don't like thunder.
Take personal privilege as the moderator. My mother, when we were scared in 4 or 5 years old to go outside during thunderstorm or just afraid of the sound of the thunder, she made us go outside and run around the house 3 times so that we wouldn't be afraid of lightning and thunder. And so I am permanently scarred, perhaps, by this, but I actually enjoy lightning and thunderstorms. Wow, that's really good. Let's jump to foreign affairs for a minute. Today, we have advisors in Iraq. We apparently have had special forces on the ground briefly on a mountaintop with refugees there. We're bombing ISIS positions. Should we be doing more? Should we be doing less in Iraq, given our history? Not all the history of what's occurred, but as to where we are today. Should we be doing more there? Should we be doing less? Should we be doing something different? And let's start with whoever has the microphone, which is Bob Smith, if we would.
Well, that region of the world, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, all of those, that region of the world has been rife with cultural and religious wars, tribal warfare, since the death of Muhammad in 632 AD. There is no interest for us being there, in my view. And we are going to get sucked into another war. I see it coming right now. Now it's advisors. Here's a guy who ran who said he was going to take us out of Iraq. And now we're going back in. And this is, look, there's a humanitarian issue here, which I understand. You got a bunch of people sitting on top of the mountains being beheaded if they come down and die if they stay up there. The mission should be defined, and the exit strategy should be defined. What do? We go in, why are we going in, and how do we get out? And here's what it should have been. This is a humanitarian issue. Okay, go to the military. General so-and-so, what do I need? to get in there, to get these people off the mountain, and then get out. I don't want any more nation building. I don't want any more attempted nation building in that area of the world. We cannot do it. Our troops are being, their hands are tied behind their backs. They're told the rules of engagement are absolutely outrageous. Talk to anybody that you know, a son, a daughter, a brother, anybody who's over there, and they will tell you off the record that the rules of engagement are outrageous and we're risking lives for nothing. Get out.
Thank you.
Jim Rubens.
We need the strongest national defense and the most technologically advanced national defense in the world, but we've made egregious mistakes in Afghanistan and Iraq, etc. These wars, these nation-building wars have failed, and we should discontinue doing them. There is a war on terrorism. There are terrorists operating in about 20 countries around the world. A part of the weakness of our U.S. national security is exemplified, our weakness of on-the-ground intelligence. As recently as September 2013, Ajin Shaheen voted to bomb Syria. The purpose of that bombing war, and this was in September last year, was to weaken al-Assad and strengthen ISIS. We did not know at the time, apparently, as far as I could detect from someone who voted this way, that we were strengthening ISIS. Now we have people in both parties proposing that we bomb ISIS. We have a haphazard military policy, a haphazard foreign policy. This is very tough to answer in 2 minutes, but I'm touching in a very small way on this. We need a much more consistent military and foreign policy focused on securing national security for Americans here in America. These wars in the Middle East have not done that. We made mistakes.
Thank you.
Scott Brown.
We have a failed foreign policy. It's dangerous. Senator Shaheen's a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. She supported the president's failed policies almost 100% of the time. What's the goal? You have to look at what the goal is. As somebody who's served in the military, that's the first thing you have to ask. And the goal for ISIS is to get their own country, get their hands on assets, natural resources, get money, and start exporting terrorism around the region and the world. That's their plan. They want to fly a flag in the White House. That's their goal. Our goal is to make sure that doesn't happen. I wrote a letter on October 11th, along with a whole host of other senators, asking that we not leave as is. Leave all those gains on the battlefield. Have a quick reaction transition force in Iraq to make sure that we could, you know, secure those gains and have an orderly transition with the new government. The president left, saying he couldn't argue a status of forces agreement and sign it. That's not true. I disagree with that wholeheartedly. He could have done it if he wanted to. The only option we have now is to work with our Arab League partners and allies to do command and control disruption, go after their supply lines, weaken them, and allow the Iraqis and the Kurds, our greatest allies in that region, who are being slaughtered, have an opportunity to survive.
Thank you. And I'm going to stay on foreign policy for a minute, and I will give you all an opportunity to speak more generally about foreign policy, but I have one other specific. And Scott Brown, I'm going to encourage you to keep the microphone a little further from your mouth. Russia has annexed the Crimea from Ukraine. Eastern Ukraine is currently in a state of war with open fighting between Russian nationals as well as the Ukrainian military. Now, apparently, there's a 280-truck convoy, supposedly humanitarian convoy, ready to march from Moscow into Ukraine. What should the United States do when it comes to Ukraine? What can we do?
Well, as a result of what we saw in Syria, you draw that red line and you cross it, boy, you're going to be in trouble. Well, we did nothing. It sent a very powerful message. And President Putin obviously has been emboldened by the Olympics, by a whole host of other things, our lack of action. We did nothing in Georgia. We've done nothing with Crimea except to, you know, do a couple of expelling a couple of diplomats or bankers or whatever. I've done nothing. It's a lack of leadership, which has been supported 100% by Senator Shaheen. So where do we go? I would have said and encouraged the president to expel them temporarily, at least from the G8-G20, authorize the immediate approval of all those natural gas contracts to allow us to export our natural resources, pay down our debt and deficit, and supply our European allies with the resources to do what they need to do. They can actually, we could do it cheaper, we could have done it, I think, more effectively, would have affected the ruble and the stock market. And then you say, by the way, we're not canceling our cuts down to World War II levels in our military, and we are going to fulfill our obligations and train with our partners in that region. It would have sent a very powerful message, but the president did nothing, and that's a problem.
Thank you. Jim Rubin.
Russia abrogated the four-way treaty that resulted in Ukraine giving up its nuclear weapons, and that's unpardonable and cannot be allowed. The economic sanctions that have progressively been ratcheting up, imposed by the Obama administration, I'll acknowledge, seem to be toning back and pushing Russia back from the brink. We do not want a ground war or another Cold War with Russia. The concept, part of our negotiating leverage, the weakness of it, is that Northern Europe had become dependent over the past 20 years on natural gas through pipelines from Russia. That was a mistake on our part and the free world's part to allow that to have happened. That's something we can't reverse. But allowing export of U.S. natural gas to Europe would not sufficiently replace the capacity of those pipelines. It would drive up energy costs in America. People are under serious pressure at the gas pump in America already. It would not solve the problem there. But we do need a long-term energy policy that makes the entire free world completely independent of natural gas from Russia and oil from OPEC. I have a plan to get there. It's on my website, jimrubins.com. I hope we have time to talk a bit more about ISIS. This is an extremely significant
issue.
I'll
come back to Bob Smith, please.
I think if you watch the body language between President Obama and Mr. Putin, you can get a pretty good understanding of how he feels about our president. Putin is a strong individual. He's a former KGB agent. We all know what they did and the kind of people they were. And you now have a situation where after the Soviet Union broke up, obviously we all know Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. You have a lot of Russian nationals who live in the Ukraine. And the bottom line is, and our policy is, you have to ask yourself, do you want your sons and daughters in the Ukraine? Do you want them fighting a war there? Then if you don't, then what we need to do is adopt the Ronald Reagan strategy, which is peace through strength. Show the Russian leader that we are a strong nation, and do it not by talk, but by action in terms of having the adequate defenses that we had. Make it very clear, I agree with Jim on the sanctions. I think they have worked somewhat. That's what you have to do. Hit them where it hurts, in the pocketbook. And I would do the same thing with terrorist nations that harbor terrorists. Don't trade with them. Don't do business with them. Ostracize them from the rest of the world and keep them isolated and keep them from getting the arms and technology they need to go further than he might do in the Ukraine. Thank you.
Thank you. The history had a different role for the Congress than we have today. History had the United States, through World War II at least, declaring war when we committed large numbers of troops. History said things like politics ends at our nation's shores, and we didn't politicize foreign policy, at least to the degree that perhaps we do today. What's the role of you as a United States Senator in our management of and operation of our foreign policy and our military policy?
Well, the Constitution says advise and consent. That's the Senate's role, to advise and consent. The Congress, the United States House of Representatives, has the power to declare war. And anybody that served in Korea or Vietnam will know damn well we were in a war, but it wasn't declared. It was a conflict, or whatever they call it. But it was real to those of us who were there, who were not getting the support and cooperation out of the government and out of the officials and the political leaders that we deserved while we were fighting it. So Congress does have a role, and it's a very important one. Number one, if we're going to go someplace, I don't care where it is, Iraq, we're in Iraq right now. Where's the Congress? What about a declaration of war? If we're fighting ISIS or anybody else over there, that's a declaration of war. If you're going to harbor, if Iraq is going to harbor terrorists, then they're harboring terrorists. That's a worthy of, if you're going to send troops there, American troops there, then have a declaration of war. Give them the support. Tell them you want to go, you're going to go there, and we're going to support you while you're there.
Thank you. Jim Rubens.
The Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution requires Congress to approve any war except in times of emergency. There are some people at this table who are advocating a third war in Iraq. A bombing war in Iraq is a war. And I have to return to this ISIS question. There is a global war on terrorism, and there are people with malintent toward America in any of 20 countries. And we do not have to prevail in this war on terror. We do not need to hold territory. We do not need to artificially impose the boundaries imposed by France and Britain post-World War I around Iraq. They're artificial. They have nothing to do with the tribal hatreds. If, however, on-the-ground intelligence, which America must beef up because it's failing, obviously Jean Shaheen voted to bomb Syria in September 2013 to help ISIS. That's absurd. We need to determine where there are threats against America, and if there are threats against America, we can use surgical techniques to eliminate them. We do not need to nation build if people who do not want nation build. We do not need to hold territory, and I am sick to my heart with our young men and women coming back from these wars without legs and arms, in caskets, with brain injuries, for no increase, no improvement in U.S. national security. There is a difference of opinion inside the Republican Party on this question, and it's something that needs to be debated, and these are serious, serious questions that need to be addressed thoughtfully. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott Brown?
We need to be a check and balance, not a rubber stamp. Right now you have a Congress that is rubber stamping. Our senator has been doing that as a member of the Foreign Relations Committee, rubber stamping the president's failed policies on foreign policy, and it's dangerous. That being said, I agree with Bob. Our role is to advise and consent and be part of the process. And the president, through his executive authority, perceived executive authority, is, I think, exceeding his privilege and taking actions, quite frankly, that are not appropriate in many instances. And we have and should be part of the process, part of the decision-making process, so we can not only make those financial decisions and supporting those efforts, being part of the process to defend our country and our interests abroad, and also make sure we can report back to our constituents why we're moving forward, and that's not happening.
Well, speaking of oversight and actions that we may or may not be comfortable with, the NSA spying, the collection of metadata, the FISA secret court that issues warrants apparently just about 100% of the time at the request of the government. Is our government spying on us to too great a degree and placing our freedoms at risk, or is our government acting appropriately to try to protect us from terrorism and the risk of attack?
Well, that's the question of the day. What's their role and how are they fulfilling that role? What started out as a credible program has turned creepy. And you have a situation where what was meant to be that check and balance to make sure terrorists would not be changing our way of life and trying to kill us, we needed a check and balance. We need to have the ability to intercept and anticipate the 9/11 type situation. So there is a role for our government and those men and women heroes in the intelligence community to find out what's next. Our role is to try to provide them with the tools and the resources to do just that, but to do it within the limits of the law and striking that balance. The balance so we know when we send our kids on a plane, they're not going to get shot down. The balance to know when they go into a building in our country, it's not going to be blown up. We have to find a balance. And that's what I look forward to having an opportunity to participate in.
Thank you. Jim Rubens.
The Patriot Act that Scott Brown voted to renew and that Senator Smith voted to initiate has resulted in an abrogation of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which protects our personal effects from being seized or searched by the government for any purpose other than when there's probable cause. We now know that this massive spying that has been conducted against hundreds of millions of Americans, innocent Americans, we now know hasn't resulted in the prevention of a single act of terrorism against America. The example of the pressure cooker bomber in Boston is recent, not detected by this massive hundreds of millions of Americans having their data breached, their personal effects breached. So we need to take a different approach to defend against terrorism. As I've mentioned, terrorism is operative around the world. We do need better intelligence on the ground. Our national defense and security is weak in this area, and we need to take specific action against individuals posing specific threats against America, not innocent Americans. The Constitution guarantees us these protections, and it cannot be abrogated.
Thank you. Bob Smith.
Mr. Monterey, earlier you gave Senator Brown an opportunity on personal privilege to respond to something. I'd like 30 seconds to respond to something before I answer this question.
And I agree, but each of the others will have an opportunity to do that 30 seconds.
Well, that's fine. I didn't respond to when he asked his personal privilege. But all I'm saying is, a few moments ago, Jim Rubin said, some people at this table are supporting policies of a third war. There are only three of us here, so that's plural. I'm not one of them. And I'm speaking for myself. I've made it very clear that I do not support these policies. I am not a neocon in this Republican Party. I'm the opposite, 180 degrees. I said earlier we need to get out of there, and that this is not an attempt at nation building. So if I'm not making any accusations against Jim, he might have misspoken, but I'm just speaking for myself that I have not that part of it. So if there's some people here, don't put me in that category.
Thank you. If you would like to respond to the NSA question.
Right. Look, I did vote for the Patriot Act. I wish I had it back. I'd like to have the vote back. Unfortunately, hindsight and armchair quarterbacking is easy. Let me tell you why I'd like to have it back. Because it was a time in when we voted 98-1, I believe the vote was, in the Senate, because of what happened. We don't have to go into details about what happened in Washington and New York. However, we were not told what this act was going to entail. They went way beyond what the act says, and there are violations of our individual rights. There are Fourth Amendment violations. I agree with what Jim said on this. It's outrageous. We should not be violating the Fourth Amendment rights of American citizens. There is a balance, supposedly, but right now we don't have a balance. The balance is the other way, and American citizens are being spied upon, and it is wrong, and it is not the direction we need to go. It's a very, very slippery slope. So I will vote, if necessary, to repeal that act and redefine it, as Jim Sensenbrenner, who wrote it, is also advocated doing. So sometimes these things happen, and this is a good example of a bureaucracy going awry and ignoring the intent of the law.
Thank you. And I'm going to simply bank an extra 30 seconds for you two guys when you choose to use it. Bob Smith, trying to use that. First of all, keep that microphone away from your mouth. Don't bring it too close. Isaac gets one more shot at you guys. I'm a little nervous about asking this, but what is the last book that you read that you really enjoyed?
What, fictional or history?
Go crazy, whatever you like. If it's 50 Shades of Grey, your wife has to leave the room.
It wasn't one that poor guy in Guilford tried to get out of the school district and got arrested, I can tell you that. Oh, I don't know. I love history. John Grisham, I think, was the last novel I read. History, McCulloch. I read Truman. I don't know if it's the last one, but I loved Harry Truman, even though he's a Democrat. Have I still got part of my 30 seconds? Let me just say about Harry Truman. It is pointed out in the McCulloch book. This applies to us today in terms of how we conduct ourselves in politics. Truman said, when he ran for re-election in 1948, if you're going to elect those Republican bastards, don't elect me, because I don't want to work with them, because I can't work with them, because they're wrong. That's what we need to say. Don't elect me if you're going to put a Democrat like Hillary Clinton in the White House, or you're going to keep electing moderates, you're going to play with the Democrats and take us down the road to more debt and more regulation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my point. And Truman won, and Reagan won by saying the same thing. So I think it's important to understand, you know, maybe sometimes it takes a good idea to look back in history and say, we did win elections with Reagan. Truman did win. I wonder why.
Thank you. Jim Rubens.
Yeah.
Brief answer. Last book you read, you really enjoy.
Extortion. Brief. It's a book, I think it's by Peter Schweitzer. It documents how Congress works. Congress is our corporate tax code, which is 65,000 pages long. It's stuffed with corporate welfare and special perks. It's driving jobs offshore. It's a part of my six-point plan to bring the jobs back to America again, to fix this thing. And Peter Schweitzer explains why it's like that, because Congress puts these tax breaks in, and then they have them expire every 2 or 4 or 6 years so that they can go out and rattle their tin cup before the lobbyists to raise the millions of dollars it requires to buy the TV ad, to put the lies up on TV and the falsehood up on TV to get yourself reelected. And you use this method of keeping this distorted tax code in order to raise money to get reelected. Washington is busted. It's corrupt to the bone. The campaign funding system we have prevents the country's problems from being solved. And I'll repeat this. This is why I support a voluntary alternative system for people who don't want to be bought and paid for in the United States Senate, who can become reelected through a public financing system.
Thank you. And Scott Brown.
First of all, I'm going to use my 30 seconds first, and I'll answer the question. Bob, First of all, I respect your service to our military, and I thought your vote on the Patriot Act was heroic and patriotic at the time, and because we were addressing a very scary time in our country's history, and to now just throw it out without actually looking at it and dissecting it and figuring out what's wrong and get rid of that, I believe we need that check and balance. I believe it takes you and people like you at the table to say, hey, this is what we need to do to fix it, because there are people out there that want to kill us and change our way of life, and I want to have the tools and resources and give our men and women who are trying to defend us that ability to do so. So that's my 30 seconds on that. With regard to the books, obviously you've been pretty busy, but I was able to read the entire Game of Thrones series, enjoyed it. I've read all of Baldacci, all of Vince Flynn, Dan Brown, Dale Brown. Right now I'm reading a biography I was given over the weekend about a woman who was part of the situation in Germany where, being Jewish, her and her family were obviously tracked and many of them killed. It's an uplifting story. Now, hopefully we'll have time to read at some point after the primary in general is over, and that's it.
Thank you. $650 billion, that's our current national deficit, $17, $18 trillion, our current national debt. It's going to take an awful lot of work, both on the spending side and on the revenue generation side, perhaps, to fill that gap, that $650 million current gap in our national deficit. What would you do? What are the cuts that need to be made? What is the revenue that you would be generating that's going to enable us to balance our budget at some time in the not too distant future? Or we're not going to do it? Is it something we're not able to do at this point and we should just keep borrowing away? I'm going to start with Jim Rubens, because he's highlighted this on his website. There you go.
Another of these non-30-second. How long do we have of this? Do we have an hour? We don't.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. You have two full minutes on this, all of you gentlemen. You address a couple of questions that people have asked here, particularly about funding for cancer research and for elder services, particularly transportation programs for the elderly. Are those the sorts of things that are going to need to be cut in order for us to balance the budget? So take your whole 2 minutes, but make sure you touch those two, if you would.
Wow, this is big. So we need a safety net in America. We're a humane people, but we can't afford the safety net we have right now. We are, if you add both the debt on the books, the 17, pushing $18 trillion, plus the unfunded future obligations for programs that we depend on, like Social Security and Medicare, CHIP, and now Obamacare is in the budget, we're underwater by about $100 trillion, and that's a mid-range estimate. We're bankrupt as a nation, and we've got to deal with it. And these programs are the third rail of American politics. And I've proposed something to do about it, because to deal with problems this immense is going to require a Congress that does not any longer kick the can down the road. We've had people in the U.S. Senate vote for debt ceiling increases, kick the can down the road, let someone deal with it 2 years. The clock has run out now. We're at the point where our balance sheet, our credit card, is maxed out. If we face a national disaster in this country, another serious war that we're obligated to participate in, like World War II, we don't have any credit left to run that anymore. So we've got to deal with that. I proposed on my website in my campaign since the very beginning, I've touched the third rail of American politics, and I've proposed means testing Social Security and Medicare for millionaires as something substantial to be put on the table so that these programs can be funded for the long term, so that our young people are not cheated. They're paying into the system. There's no money to pay for their Social Security in the system. We've got to get honest about the budget. And again, my case is Congress has failed to deal with this. People, incumbents in office, have failed to deal with this problem, voted for these debt ceiling increases, done nothing about it. Decade after decade, we've come to the point now we've got to deal with it. I proposed that we do something like the Military Base Closing Commission approach, that we do one more debt ceiling increase, but set in place a super committee of members of the House and Senate to put forth a plan to deal with our long-term budget, put it to the Congress, both bodies, for an up or down supermajority vote to deal with this long-term problem. If these aren't the answers, I implore people running for office, put other suggestions on the table so our nation is fiscally stable.
Thank you. Bob Smith? Scott. I think
I'm at the ready.
Defense of Republican unity will go to Scott Brown, because that's what Jim Rubens is there.
That's fine. Well, first of all, thanks. Jim, some good ideas in there, and it's important to have those ideas on the table. It's a specific question, funding for cancer. Gail and I just did a tandem ride on the Pan Mass Challenge, 111 miles in the pouring rain to help cancer and cancer survivors. Gail's stepdad just passed away from cancer, so it's personal. I worked through NIH to make sure we can continue with that research, work through our nonprofits like Dana-Farber and others, obviously, to have that help. Elder services, we're all living it right now. My mom is getting very needy. That's why Gail and I are spending so much time with her, have been working on those issues for many, many years. When you pass a budget, when the House sends up a budget, in order to bring it forward, you have to vote for it. You have to vote for that budget to come forward. It's part of the process. And then when you vote to bring it forward, everyone says, oh, you're voting to cut A, B, C, and D. They think that you agree with the House priorities. Well, in order to move forward on the budget, you have to actually bring it forward and actually then fight for the things that you believe in. And those two things are things that I absolutely believe in, along with a whole host of other things. But we've gotten into this trouble not overnight, and it's not going to be fixed overnight. Let's be realistic. But one of the major things we can do regarding our deficits in particular, well, they passed a budget recently, and they were patting themselves on the back, and it was still $800 billion, give or take, in the hole. And they'd say, oh, this is great. Well, no offense, they did it by, and Senator Sheen voted for it, by balancing it on the back of our veterans' pensions. I never would have supported that. The first thing that we need to do is allow the majority leader and the minority leaders to actually get back to the ordinary order and allow the committees to do their jobs. You're in favor, you're in armed services, education, the small business. Go through all these committees and say, you have to find X amount because we're going to put out a budget. How about that? And we're going to put a budget out that's balanced. In order to do that, you need to come up with savings. And by the way, we're not going home, and we're not leaving at 12 o'clock on Thursday and coming back Monday night at 6. We're not going home on the weekends. We're not going to, you know, we're going to miss vacations, folks, and we're going to do your jobs. That's the first thing you got to do. Thank and if we have other opportunities, I'm happy to come back.
Fair enough. Bob Smith.
Well, since we have the Democrat tracker here, let me just say to the Democrats, I'll make you a deal. President Obama and Jeanne Shaheen, send the illegal aliens home and give us the money that you're paying to take care of them and all the services we're providing in this country, and let's give it to the research for the elderly and cancer research. That'd be a good start right there. Look, I hear all this story about revolving doors and people coming back from Congress and going into the lobbying firms. Count me out. I didn't do any of that, and number one. And number two, check those 5,000 votes. I voted for balanced budgets starting in 1985. I never voted for one that wasn't balanced. I didn't vote for foreign aid when it was giving money to the enemy. Look at the votes. Talk is cheap. There's a lot of it up here, including me. I understand that. And people are frustrated with it. But talk is over. It's time for action. We have to reform entitlements. You can cut everything out of the discretionary budget. Everything, all 20% of it, including defense, if you did. And you still can't balance it. Because you, if you had it, if we, in this room right now, we had the task of balancing the budget, we couldn't do it, no matter what your priorities were, because the law says we have to fund almost 80% of our budget by law in entitlements. They must be reformed. The Congress has not had the guts to do it. It's very easy. I'll give you, I know how, in 30 seconds, one quick thing. There are young people right here sitting in this room who are paying 12.4% into a Social Security system every single paycheck. Guess what? There's no Social Security Trust Fund. There ain't no money there, folks, and you're not going to get a nickel of it. When you're our age or my age, you're not going to get it. So what's an answer? I'll tell you, here's a simple answer. Let me pick a portion of that 12.4%. The actuaries can figure it out. And I will take that and I will put it in my own fund, my own investment, kept so that you can't take it out until you're retired. And then at the end of the day, I won't take as much money as I'm entitled to. Let me have what I put in. The Social Security Trust Fund gains, the debt goes down, and the guy goes off and retires with a hell of a lot more money he would have under Social Security. That's the kind of stuff we need to do. But one quick point, let's final point. Simpson Bowles, we tried this and it didn't work. With these commissions.
Another full minute on this, so that you do have a chance to finish it.
All right, thank you.
I'll stay with you, but let's try and get at something that hurts a little bit. Jim Rubens has pointed out that he's prepared to consider mean testing for Social Security and Medicare, which means taxes. People are going to have to pay more taxes.
No,
would you?
Does not mean that.
No, I'm sorry. I'll let you explain it. Probably smarter for me not to try to explain your position on things.
Let's talk about what's a little bit difficult. What's going to be painful for us? What are we going to have to pay in greater taxes? What are we not going to get in terms of benefits? Where are the cuts going to come from? And where's the additional revenue going to come from if we're actually serious about balancing the budget? Bob Smith, 1 minute.
All right, we don't need additional revenue. We do not need additional revenue except what is created by cutting the taxes on the American people and allow growth. It's a two-railed system. They need to cross, they need to connect downstream. And here's what happens. Cut regulation, cut the corporate tax, eliminate the capital gains tax, and frankly, don't pass things like Dodd-Frank, which Scott Brown voted for, proudly he said. You're strangling, and there gotta be people in this room who are bankers or financial services people are getting killed by this stuff. Don't vote for that stuff. Cut those taxes and regulations and let business grow, and you will produce more revenue, as Ronald Reagan did. And at the same time, do the tough things. Reform entitlements. They must be reformed. I just gave you an example of one way to do it. Means testing, maybe, but that doesn't solve the problem. All you're doing is delaying the agony. It's not a sound actuarial system. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's a Social Security Trust Fund. You've got to reform it. You've got to let people make their own choices and pay. Keep our promises to those who are in the trust fund, absolutely. But in the meantime, let's reform it and other entitlements.
Thank you. Jim Rubin.
We touch on quite a few subjects here, but we've got to find cuts everywhere in the budget. We still have a raisin control board in the United States of America. If you grow raisins in California, you're subject to this. We don't need it anymore. We have the F-35 bomber, which can't take off below 65 degrees Fahrenheit. It's projected to cost $1 trillion. The Pentagon has 230-plus golf courses around the world. There are things we can do to cut budgets. We've got 50-plus job training programs in the United States of America run under four different cabinet-level agencies, a tenth of which have ever been tested for effectiveness. So there is a lot of pork in this federal budget. But in the end, as Bob says, we've got to deal with entitlements. And there's no way to do it without touching that third rail and putting some serious proposals on the table. And you'll notice that other candidates typically don't put anything serious on the table because it's too difficult. If you have candidates that are unwilling to put serious, big, bold agenda items on the table to fix problems, they won't get fixed. If you're not brave enough to do it during a campaign, you're certainly not going to be brave enough to do it during a Congress. Finally, just very briefly on science, my mom passed away way too young of colorectal cancer. I'm a very, very strong supporter of what the National Institutes of Health does to support research, primary medical research in the underlying causes of cancer and other diseases. It has made America the strongest in the world in biotechnology and medicine. I support that kind of pre-commercial energy R&D. Not picking winners and losers, but gaining for us the knowledge, the fundamental knowledge on a molecular basis of how cancer forms, and we will defeat this disease in doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. And you're now all even with regard to your time. Scott Brown?
That's fine. First of all, the only way anything's going to be done is to have a bipartisan, bicameral approach that the president's going to sign. And that's the reality of what's happening right now in the United States Congress with the president being who he is. They're like pigs at a trough. The more money you send them, the more they're going to spend. There's no check and balance. To think that, and some good suggestions up here, all of those suggestions should be brought to the table, close the doors, and have everybody bring forth their priority, like was attempted with Simpson-Bowles and other super-duper committees with sequestration and the like. Well, guess what? After all of those efforts, nothing was done. Because of partisan petty politics, not putting our country's interests first. We can do certainly the balanced budget amendment. I've sponsored it. I agree with Bob on that regard, looking at that top-to-bottom review of every federal program, giving the president the line item veto. There are some common sense things we absolutely can do and should do. But the only way it's going to be done is to get everybody together and put their country's interests first, as Americans first, and recognize that a $17 trillion national debt is putting us at a military and an economic jeopardy. We're not as strong as we could be as a country. Look forward to, I've asked to be part of that process, and look forward to having that opportunity.
Thank you. And if I could really test you, all three of you, with regard to your conciseness, Can you take 1 minute to address two different issues? One is medicinal marijuana, and in general, whether the federal government should continue to treat marijuana as a Schedule I drug, and also your position on the minimum wage, and specifically the national minimum wage. And I'm going to start with Scott Brown. If you could address both those in 1 minute, that would be great.
Sure. Medicinal marijuana, I had a young lady with seemed to have a friend who was affected by it. I agree that if there's no other alternatives, and this is the only remaining option through a doctor's supervision and request, absolutely. I don't agree with what's happening in other states, in Colorado in particular, and others, with having the marijuana shops just pop up. I don't think it sets a good example for our kids. With regard to the minimum wage, so what's the conversation? It's another effort by the federal government to dictate what employers are going to be paying. And I have supported minimum wage increases before. I think they need to be periodically adjusted and reviewed. But the key is you have to have the job creators at the table, the people that are actually paying the bills. Because if you look at what's happening, highest corporate tax rate in the industrialized world, Obamacare, then you have the cost of energy, which is going to be out of control, especially if you have natural gas. We don't have the pipeline or the delivery capacity, storage capacity for our energy costs. Then you have the cost of, obviously, labor, advertisement, just opening up the doors. You add all that up, and then you're saying, oh, by the way, we're going to force you to pay X amount. Happy to periodically adjust it. Happy to be part of the process, but our job creators need to be at the table.
Thank you. Jim Rubens, two questions.
I oppose a federal, contrary to Senator Brown, Scott Brown, I oppose a federally mandated minimum wage of any kind. What we do need to do, and I go back to my six-point jobs plan, we need to raise the middle class back up in this country, back to the point where people can earn far more than minimum wage. And we've been under serious wage pressure in this country. Since Obama Shaheen took over, real wages for the average American family have dropped 6 to 8%. This is intolerable. Reform the tax code, dial back regulations like Dodd-Frank and Obamacare, reduce energy costs, I go back to my plan. We need to stabilize the American currency so that people live here, close the borders so that jobs go to Americans who are legally entitled to be here. As to medical marijuana, we have 20-plus states now that are breaching federal law. The drug war has failed. It's engendering violence in Mexico and the Central American countries. We ought to, under the 10th Amendment, delegate back to the states the job, like with alcohol, of regulating marijuana. If states want to have medical marijuana, and they're now breaching the law, let them do it. Let them regulate it, tax it as they wish. It's important to note, however, that marijuana does have side effects. It does cause potentially schizophrenia. It causes brain changes in young people. People should be aware of that. But those harms, we should also be honest, are less than the harms caused by nicotine and nicotine delivery devices like cigarettes and alcohol.
Thank you. Bob Smith, two questions.
Medical marijuana, absolutely. I know people who have benefited from it, and hurts, saves pain and suffering, of course, under the supervision of a doctor. Nothing wrong with it. I also agree with Jim on the state. This is a state issue, not a federal issue. Should not be under the 10th Amendment, it should not be a federal mandate. Let the states deal with it. That's appropriate. On the minimum wage, I disagree with Scott Brown as strongly as I can, agree with Jim. The point is, what on earth does the federal government have to do with telling you how much you pay your employees? I hope that everybody gets a big pay raise. I hope everybody has something far in excess of the minimum wage, but let the market deal with it. This is America. This is what's wrong. How much does that cost for a business? I mean, when you mandate a minimum wage on some employer, they're going to probably have to lay somebody off. And how does that help? So I'm baffled, really, that anybody in the Republican Party could be supportive of Dodd-Frank and a mandated minimum wage.
Thank you. And Bob Smith, we're gonna keep giving. You'll have the opportunity to use some of your time to do that. With our remaining time, we're pretty limited. Our last 90-second question is going to be very generic, which is simply, we have a problem with regard to illegal immigration, with regard to children coming across our borders. How, in 90 seconds, would you address that, Bob Smith?
90
seconds, go.
Maybe the other 180 of these guys can finish what I said. Don't start yet. Look, This is now, in my view, the number one issue. We started out with Obamacare. That's terrible. There's no doubt about it. But listen, the borders are gone in America. They are gone, folks. There are no borders. Are you aware of the fact that President Obama is putting people on an airplane, flying them from their country of origin, whether it's Honduras or Guatemala or wherever, and flying them over the border, landing them somewhere in the United States, taking them off the plane and dispersing them throughout the land? Some of them may be right here in New Hampshire. Do you also know, are they being treated medically? Do they have any medical issues? I don't know. Do they have any ID? I don't think so. Where are they going? And why are they here? The President of the United States is violating the immigration laws of our country. He's not only violating them, he's ignoring them. That's the first prong, as if that wasn't bad enough. But at the border, these poor folks at the border security people, how in the world are they going to stop this? They don't have the support of the administration. People are encouraged to come here. As long as they're encouraged to come here because they're going to get free services or they're going to be sent to Uncle somebody out in somebody's land somewhere and not be interrupted, why on earth wouldn't they come? We know there's squalor and poverty where they're coming from, but finally, these are not political refugees. These are illegal immigrants brought here with the consent and approval of this administration. And it's ruining our country, and we better deal with it.
Thank you. Jim Rubin.
I haven't met a single American in campaigning over the past 14 months that opposes immigration. We're a nation of immigrants. My parents, on my mom's side, came over in the Mayflower. We were apparently not fitting in over in Britain, and we came here. So we are strengthened by immigration, but the illegal immigration has got to stop. We're the only advanced nation in the world that has an open border like we do. We need to build a fence, both physical and technological, and let the world know that you can't come here except legally. We can't import diseases, and we can't send... Look at Manchester, New Hampshire, where they have 50 different languages spoken in their school system. It's overwhelming the capacity of our country. And also, we need to stop being a magnet for immigrants, as Bob has suggested. Senator Brown, Scott Brown here, voted to make Massachusetts a magnet for immigrants by providing illegal people who are here benefits in America. So we attract people when we tell people we're gonna take benefits that should go to Americans and give them to people here illegally. That aggravates and compounds the problem. Jobs should go to Americans, jobs only to people who are legally here and who are citizens here.
Thank you. Scott Brown.
So once again, to correct the record, the bill that Jim's referring to allow in-state tuition, it was done in error. We immediately contacted the Governor Romney. He vetoed it. It was not overridden. I have a long and strong record on this issue, and to misrepresent it is somewhat laughable. When you talk about, excuse me, Jim, I'm answering the question. So did everybody vote for it, and immediately it was in error. Anyway. We have a situation where we have porous borders. We need to close the border once and for all. Senator Shaheen has voted twice against sending troops to the border. She supports the DREAM Act. Those magnets that you're referring to, they are real. When the president uses his executive order to actually say to folks outside of our borders, hey, by the way, just get your kids here and you'll be okay. We'll take care of them. And to redefine what is a refugee, to go and actually take a group of people who are here illegally and put them ahead of the almost 4+ million people who are trying to do the right thing and follow our laws is wrong. It sends a very terrible message. We should actually allow for the people that are in our colleges and universities to get a diploma and stay here and work here appropriately, making sure whatever we do, we should not incentivize that illegality and reward it. So whatever proposal we're going to do to drag them out of the shadows, so-called, we need to do it by making sure that they're not getting the EBT card, the other benefits during that process.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are ready for our closing statements as a result of coin flips and things like that. We have Bob Smith starting out first. We have Jim Rubens in the middle and Scott Brown at the end. Bob Smith, you have 1 minute for that closing statement, and please don't hold back. Feel free to applaud at the end of this statement.
Well, I think you heard a pretty good debate on the issues. I think you saw some major differences here. I think the question for all of you as voters in this primary is who best can stand up to Jean Shaheen and contrast who we are and who they are. That's the issue. Because if we don't do that, we will not win. We cannot, if I were Jean Shaheen and Scott Brown were the nominee, here's what I would say. Scott, we agree on life. We agree on gun control. You voted more with the Democrats than Republicans. I did. And you voted for Dodd-Frank and so did I. Why should people vote for you over me? The point is we can't win that way. With all due respect, I like Scott. He's a good guy. I like him a lot. I'd like to have a beer with him once in a while. But the point is, it's not about that. It's not about me. It's not about him. It's not about Jim. It's not about any of us. It's about saving our country. There's only one party that's going to do it, and it's this party. And the only way we win is if we stick to the principles of our party platform. You walk from that, you lose. Period. That's why our country is in trouble. So I ask for your vote respectfully because of that.
Thank you, Bob.
There are only 100 United States senators in Washington, D.C., and all laws, both made and the laws we need to change, must go through there, and 60 votes are required to get things through the United States Senate. There are only 2 United States senators here in New Hampshire. We have in office in Jean Shaheen a placeholder. Risk-averse, avoids controversy, does not lead. We need what I've done in my life, my 40 years here in public and business and private life here in the state. We need thoughtful, principled statesmanship. We need bold ideas put on the table that break through the gridlock of Washington, ideas that are powerful enough to bring together those 60 votes. That's what I've done. It's what I did in the state Senate, and it's what I offer. Again, I have to ask you to go to my website to see. I have more ideas on my website than I think any other candidate I've seen in the state that are designed to solve problems and break through. Again, what we need is thoughtful, principled statesmanship to break through this gridlock in Washington. Thank you, folks.
First of all, thank you for holding this. Thank you for your activism and participation. I do have a lot of respect for Jim and Bob and their supporters. And if I don't prevail, I will that night support whoever prevails, period. I would ask them to do the same because a united Republican Party with those good independents and disgruntled JFK Reagan Democrats would be Senator Shaheen and the Democrats' worst nightmare. And I can assure you that Senator Shaheen and President Obama are not supporting me. I would be their worst nightmare going down there because they know that I'm not a rubber stamp as we have right now. I am an independent voter and thinker. I always have been. I read the bills. I see how they affect our state, our country, our debt and deficit and vote. I'm an American first. I'm not a Republican first. I'm an American. And right now, we are in trouble. And I'm the only one at this table who's been a lifelong Republican. And I'll put my Republican credentials against anyone in this room and in this country because we are a party of good and bold ideas, the party of Reagan, the party of Lincoln, who ended slavery. We helped women get the right to vote, the party of Reagan with good opportunity. That's my party. And you need to be part of it. So I ask for everyone's vote. Thank you.